Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty again, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and well, today our special guest is Daniel Hopsicker, and Daniel's an investigative reporter who's written a number of books. He actually was down in Florida trying to get the truth about Muhammad Atif. Now, Muhammad Atif was supposedly the man who led the attack on the World Trade Center. And he was this fundamentalist, an extremist Muslim who, had simply shaved off his beard so he wouldn't look like an extremist Muslim. But he was an extremist Muslim who wanted, of course, to go to heaven where there's 72 virgins and all of the wonderful benefits that accrue to every Muslim who's there. And Daniel's done treatises on that. He's talked to Muhammad Atif's girlfriend. And then, of course, he's written on the drug smuggling in the CIA, which hasn't made him very popular with the CIA, has it, Daniel?
Hey, Dr. Stan, how are you?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. Well, why don't we just start off maybe talking about what you've learned about Muhammad Atif. And did he have any connections with the government, or did he train on any of the government bases?
Well, that's probably the biggest or second biggest secret about why he was here. When I started looking into Muhammad Atif, of course, my focus was on Venice, Florida, which is where three of the four terrorist pilots learned to fly. And why I came to Venice, Florida, and found the whole story suspicious was because my parents retired down here in Venice, Florida, 30 years ago. And so I knew from personal experience, I lived in Los Gatos at one time, and I would fly out to Florida to see my folks for four or five nights every winter. And if, like, the third or fourth night here, I was restless enough to have to want to go out and have a beer, there was no place to go and nothing to do. This is, I discovered later, but I already knew for a fact that it's the second oldest population in the entire United States. So if you're a terrorist coming to the U.S., knowing that your life may have just a very short time to go, and there's 220 flight schools in Florida alone, why would you choose to come to Venice, Florida? I'd certainly choose Fort Lauderdale or Miami or someplace, you know, where I might have a little more fun in my last year of life. So I focused on Venice, but what I discovered when I looked into the whole story of how Muhammad Atif, it's an untold story, it's secret history, how Muhammad Atif got from Cairo to Hamburg.
How did he get there?
He was recruited.
But who recruited him?
A couple whose names have never been revealed.
I see. Does the government know who they are?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And so do the newspaper reporters that did the stories. But apparently, they forgot that the news is supposed to be who, what, when, where, and why. And they got stuck on who, because they all told the story of how this German couple from Hamburg went down to Cairo and met with Muhammad Atif's father, or friend of the family, and then met with Atif's father. And Atif's father recommended Atif to go back to Hamburg with them to go to graduate school. Well, Atif was an undistinguished student at the University of Cairo, and couldn't have gotten into graduate school in Egypt. And yet this couple from Germany took him to Hamburg and paid all his expenses and had him live with them for 6 months when he got there. And the first question, of course, I had to ask was why?
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Daniel Hopsicker and the true story of Muhammad Atif. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Daniel Hopsicker, who I've known in the past and interviewed him before and met at various conferences. And Daniel, of course, after 9/11, went to Venice, Florida, where actually Muhammad Atta had taken some of his flight training. And, of course, he was recounting to us the background of Muhammad Atta. Muhammad Atta had been recruited by a German couple. Muhammad was going to school in Cairo. He wasn't a very good student. And yet, of course, this German couple, whose name has never been revealed, although the government knows, other people know, but they haven't ever told the American people, the German couple actually went to Cairo, caught Muhammad Atta, took him back to Hamburg, where they lived. He lived with them for 6 months while he was in graduate school, and of course he wasn't capable of going to graduate school. He couldn't have even gotten to graduate school in Cairo. So what was he doing in graduate school in Hamburg? And you pick up the story from there, Daniel.
Well, the answer to those questions came out later, after 9/11, when a German newspaper in Frankfurt reported that Muhammad Atta, while he was in Hamburg, had been a recipient of a scholarship, had been a member of what is known as the Congress Bundestag program. And the Congress Bundestag program is exactly what it sounds like. It's a joint program of the U.S. Congress and the German Bundestag. And what it does is recruit, on what basis, we don't know, engineering students from around the world to come to the United States and Germany to study, and pays for their expenses. So fact number one, which has never come out, is that our tax money paid for Muhammad Atta while he was in Germany. Your tax money and my tax money. He was the recipient. He worked for 4 years for this German Bundestag, Congress Bundestag program. For 4 years. And of course, if you think about it, he was in a graduate program in architecture, which is a two-year program, and he went to Hamburg in 92 and left in 98, so he took 6 years to go through a two-year program and was funded for at least four of those 6 years by tax money from the German government and our government. So right away, you know that there's something going on there. You know what it reminds me of, Dr. Stan? It reminds me of the story of Lee Harvey Oswald. To anyone that ever says that
hold that thought for just a moment, Daniel. We want to bring other stations on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Daniel is telling us that Muhammad Atta was recruited, I guess, in about 1994, something like that. Was it 94 when was he recruited?
92.
And then, of course, he was there in Hamburg for 6 years, at least 4 years of that time. He was funded by a scholarship fund that was funded by American and German tax money, taking a two-year course and stretching it out to 6 years as he was learning to be an architect. So he was there from 92 till 98. So, and you have to understand, ask why they would take a young man from Egypt, who really wasn't a very good student, and bring him up there and finance him for all that time, studying architecture in Hamburg. So pick up the story.
It reminds me of the story of Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. Marine at a top secret U.S. base, very sensitive in Japan, that controlled U-2 flights over Russia. And then Lee Harvey Oswald defects to Russia, and then Lee Harvey Oswald comes back from Russia. And when he comes back from Russia, he's living with a family that has longtime connections to American intelligence, the Payne, and his sponsor, George Demoroshel, is a long time connected to the CIA. And the question I asked someone who knew at one point about Oswald was, did Oswald know anybody that wasn't connected with American intelligence or with the spook world in general? And the same could be said for Muhammad Atta. I mean, we've just talked about his time in Germany before he ever came to Florida. And you know that they haven't told us the truth about what he was doing there and under whose auspices he was there. So then he comes to Florida, and he's got 220 flight schools in Florida alone to choose from, and he chooses one in this tiny town with nothing but blue-haired widows, and nobody suggested he had a fetish for blue-haired widows. And three of the four terrorist pilots learned to fly at two tiny schools, the Venice, Florida airport. Each one of the flight schools at this airport had been purchased in the year before the terrorists began to arrive by two separate Dutch nationals who pretend not to know each other. Now, I called, because at that point I had met some interesting people, a famous Southern lawman for whom Jack Ruby was an informant back in the 50s. Interesting character, this guy. When I found out that both of the flight schools in Venice, each of which had trained terrorists that killed Americans, terrorist pilots, rather, were owned, had been purchased the year before by two separate Dutch nationals. And I asked him what he thought of that. And in his southern drawl, he said, well, he thought that was just one damn Dutch boy too many. He said, it's untidy. And indeed it is. And so the story on its face of the hijackers in Florida is as absurd as the magic bullet story that was told to us after the Kennedy assassination. And it's simple. You don't need to be a genius to realize that if two separate Dutch nationals show up and buy two flight schools and then terrorists began to flood the area, you know, something's going on.
All right, fine. Well, is there any connection at all between the flight schools and the Central Intelligence Agency or the CIA and drugs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here is, Dr. Stan, the biggest secret, biggest dirty secret about 9/11. And I'm proud that I'm the one that turned it up. During the same month that Muhammad Atta and his bodyguard Marwan al-Sheikhi arrived to attend Huffman Aviation in Venice, Florida, July of 2000, during that same month, a Learjet belonging to the owner of the flight school was surrounded by DEA agents on a runway at Orlando Executive Airport. And when they searched the plane, they found 43 pounds of heroin. 43 pounds of heroin on board. The Orlando Sentinel called it the biggest drug bust in Central Florida history. Now, my gosh, Dr. Stan, can you imagine? I mean, this is not like we're talking about the biggest drug bust in Central Idaho history. This is Florida history. Can you imagine how big a drug bust has to be to get on the charts in Florida?
Well, I think it's interesting, of course. It's a Dutch national. He's got a small flight school. He's got a Learjet. He must have an awful lot of money. He's certainly not making that teaching people to fly.
Well, now, see, let me explain just momentarily. The two Dutch nationals didn't actually own the flight schools that they purported to own. Each was owned in turn by someone shadowy behind the scenes. Rudy Dekkers, who everyone remembers from his umpteen television appearances after 9/11, explaining to us who the hijackers were, reported to own Huffman Aviation. He did not at any point own Huffman Aviation. Huffman Aviation was purchased by a secretive financier named Wallace J. Hilliard, a retired, understand this now, Wally Hilliard at that point was a 70-year-old retired insurance executive from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who retired to Naples, Florida, bought two flight schools, and over 40 jets.
40 jets?
Correct. Now, which, according to his jet manager, were soon flying all over the world. All over the world. Now, most folks, and my parents retire in Florida, I know about this. They come down here to play golf. They come down here to play shuffleboard. They come down here for potluck dinners. I imagine owning 40 jets that are all over the world might tend, you know, to give you a little bit of worry. It isn't something you would think a retired guy would want to get involved in, would you? It makes no sense.
Well, so much of what happened as far as 911 just doesn't make any sense. So what did you find out?
About what?
What would you like to know specifically? Where does this go? We have the guy who owns
Let's puzzle this out together, Dan. Let's puzzle this out together. Right. Where does heroin come from?
Well, primarily right now, we're getting it. The heroin, a lot of it's coming from Afghanistan. Is there any coming from South America? Or is it mostly Afghanistan?
Yes, but then as now, most of the world's heroin came from Afghanistan.
Right. And, of course, the cocaine comes from Colombia.
From South, yeah, exactly. Even though they produce some heroin down there now, too. Okay, so, now, if I'm a prosecutor, I mean, and prosecutors make this case all the time. If I own a flight school, and all of a sudden I've got terrorists associated with Osama bin Laden coming to my flight school, and I have my Learjet busted by the DEA, and they found 43 pounds of heroin, I mean, any prosecutor worth his salt is going to make the connection that that heroin's coming from Afghanistan and that I am doing business with Osama bin Laden.
So what happened to the gentleman whose Learjet was seized? Was he ever prosecuted?
Not a thing.
He wasn't prosecuted?
As best I could, left a trail of breadcrumbs, okay, that in 30 years' time, someone will figure out, or on the off chance, to break the case of 9/11, all we need is a prosecutor with the ability to compel testimony. I mean, that's, you know, if you want to solve a murder in Monterey, you know, I mean, you need to be a prosecutor that can bring somebody in and question them under oath. And until somebody has that, both that ability and the will, these people will walk among us. So if you ask who they are, well, I mean, clearly, nothing goes on in Florida that the CIA doesn't know about.
And, of course, the thing is that the CIA is in charge of what's going over in Afghanistan. And certainly when the wicked Taliban controlled Afghanistan, there was very little drug production. Once they got rid of the Taliban, why, the poppy fields bloomed. Why, when we control Afghanistan, our military is there, can't we stop the growing of poppies? It would be reasonable to think, any reasonable person would think we would try to shut down the poppy production, but we've never done that. We seem to be more interested in getting it going again.
Okay. Now, I have just indicted the CIA as being complicit in Mohammed Atta's being in Florida in the first place. Okay?
All right.
But I am no fan of the Taliban. When the Taliban said they were going to stop heroin production, they were lying. What happened when the Taliban took power is that heroin production in the home province of Mullah Omar tripled. During the year in 2000, when they said they were going to cut back production, the UN says they doubled it, and they did. So, I mean, we're in a situation. I mean, it's not like, you know, because we're indicting the CIA for being involved in this, that makes the CIA's opposition over there saintly. They weren't.
Okay.
So somebody here, clearly, the implication is, and it can be proven, is that somebody with access to the levers of power in the U.S. government, and that would mean the CIA, for example, was doing business with Osama bin Laden up till September 11th. And it's a dirty business. And what federal prosecutors say the business that was being done was, in New Jersey, they found a case where Stinger missiles were being traded. The business that was being done with bin Laden surreptitiously before September 11th was oil and guns for drugs and training. In other words, they had oil and heroin, and we had training and guns. And so nobody's lost their job because Mohammed Atta was in the U.S. to begin with, and certainly somebody should have.
I see. Well, of course, nobody was ever punished for what happened on 9/11. All the people who were involved were promoted. Everything surrounding what happened is still soft secret. 1,100 testimonies from the 9/11 Commission, people who testified about what happened because they knew what happened on 9/11. They sealed those testimonies for 50 years because they didn't want Osama bin Laden to learn what happened that morning. At least that's what they're telling the American people, and there are an awful lot of people who believe it. We'll be back in just a moment with Daniel Hofsicker. you know, analyzing what really happened in Venice, Florida before 9-1-1. Well, Daniel, you pick up the story.
Are we ready? Are we there?
We're right there. We're just waiting for you.
Okay. Well, so there's the big dirty secret. The FBI, a week after September 11th, Robert Mueller gave a press conference in which he said that the FBI knew the terrorists were training at U.S. flight school. What he never said, and what nobody ever compelled him to respond to, is if you knew terrorists were training, why didn't you do anything about it? And the reason they didn't do anything about it was because it was part of a protected drug smuggling activity. And now here, where what I found in Venice, Florida, jibes perfectly with what someone who I don't even know discovered up in Washington, D.C. Translator Sybil Edmonds, translator for the FBI, whistleblower, said she saw documents that convinced her that the State Department after September 11th was protecting a drug smuggling activity, drug smuggling network that had been doing business with the terrorists, was involved with the terrorists.
And do you think that Muhammad Atta was involved then with drug smuggling for the CIA?
Absolutely. Well, he was a drug lieutenant for Osama bin Laden.
All right, fine. And so is
and you know, when a cartel in Colombia sells cocaine to the mob here in the U.S., which distributes to retail, you imagine there's a liaison officer on both ends, right? The Cali cartel has, you know, Senor Gomez, who meets, Mr. Goomba, and the two of them, coordinate the trade, and that's indeed what Muhammad Atta was here to do, I believe.
All right. Is there any proof of that, or is this something sort of you suspect this is what he was doing? Is there because I know you've been investigating this for a long time, and you certainly talked to his girlfriend. Were you able to come up with anything that other than the assumption? Now, certainly, it may very well be a correct assumption, but could we prove it in a court of law?
Sure, you could. I mean, they make cases like this every day. I mean, we are talking a conspiracy here, a conspiracy case. Okay. If we were to charge Wallace J. Hilliard, the owner of Huffman Aviation, whose Learjet was found with 43 pounds of heroin on board, with conspiracy, as part of a continuing criminal enterprise, all we would have to do is to prove that the heroin found on his plane had something to do with Muhammad Atta's presence at his flight school. And that's an entirely logical assumption. No, I mean, do I know of anyone that saw Muhammad Atta with 10 pounds of heroin? No. No, but his entire demeanor while he was here was that of a drug boss.
All right, now
not that of a Muslim student.
He did
cocaine.
What did you learn from Muhammad Atta's girlfriend? Because he did have a girlfriend here, didn't he?
Sure. Well, let me tell you the first thing I learned, Dr. Stan. First thing I learned is that Muhammad Atta hated Americans. That Muhammad Atta was a psychopath. And that Muhammad Atta was at the controls of the plane that hit the World Trade Center. And let me tell you how I know that.
All right.
His girlfriend, it took me 6 months to find her, and it's a long story, and it's in my book, Walking the Terrorland. And you can get it from my website, madcowprod.com, or probably order it through you. She mimicked his accent at one point, okay?
Hold that thought for just a minute. We want to bring our stations on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Daniel Hopsicker. And Daniel has done a lot of investigation of Muhammad Atta, and he feels that there's a definite relationship between Muhammad Atta, this flight school, the fact that the man who ran the flight school had a jet. They found 43 pounds of heroin on there, on board that plane. And despite that fact, and there was no question about, that's why the man was never prosecuted, the owner, or at least the man who was running the flight school that Muhammad Atta was attending was never prosecuted. And, of course, it is Daniel's suggestion and presumption that Muhammad Atta was involved with the CIA operation that was smuggling drugs into the United States. and he was going to tell us about Muhammad Atta's girlfriend. And Daniel actually spent 6 months tracking down Muhammad Atta's girlfriend. So what did you find from her, and why do you believe that Muhammad Atta was at the controls of the plane that hit the World Trade Center?
Well, for three reasons. He hated Americans. He told her many times. He hated Americans. He was a psychopath. When she threw him out of their joint apartment, he said he would get even with her. And when she came back a week later, she had a cat that had just had a litter of kittens. And when she came back a week later from her job as a lingerie model, came back in the early morning and turned the lights on in the apartment, there were kitten parts all over the apartment. And her mother cat had been gutted on the kitchen table. Don't tell me that's not a psychopath.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly, it doesn't sound like a very nice person, that's for sure.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And the third thing is the accent. She mimicked his accent for me, and it wasn't an accent that I placed, okay? It didn't sound like anything I'd heard before. And so it was just one of those things that kind of stuck with me, okay? I mean, there's a million things I never got to the bottom of, and that was one of them. And then I happened to be in Washington, D.C. for the last week of the 9/11 Commission hearings, and they finally, after 2 years, played the damn tape, or portions of the tape, the cockpit tape, and I heard that accent. That was his voice. So I became immediately, instantly, convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that was Muhammad Atta.
Okay, fine.
We have some planes, okay? Everyone, don't do anything stupid.
All right, fine. So basically, was she felt that did she feel he was involved with drug smuggling, or did she have any idea where he was getting his money? It takes a lot of money to, of course, to go to flight school. And did he work at all?
No. Well, first of all, he was already a pilot when he got here.
All right.
Dr. Stantz.
So why did he go to flight school if he was already a pilot?
That was his cover. That was his cover. Okay? Every spy has what's known as a legend. Okay? If you're the CIA and the FBI and you bust in on me and you go, what the hell are you doing here? You know, I need to have a story that I can tell you. I need a legend. Okay? And his legend was that he was a flight student. He had pilot licenses from half dozen countries. He saw when they fell out of his flight bag one time. So clearly, being a flight student was merely his cover. That was his excuse to be here. And clearly, Wally Hilliard, the man that owned 40 jets, was a cutout for the CIA. And he was fronting for the CIA's airline, unless there's another government agency that owns 40 jets.
Well, that is an awful lot of jets for a retired man to be owning and flying all over the world.
You can only fly one at a time, right? You can only fly, and his. We haven't even talked about who Wally Hilliard was buddies with. It wasn't like Wally Hilliard was just this retired insurance executive with no friends in high places. Wally Hilliard took phone calls regularly from Bill Clinton. Wally Hilliard knew President Bush. Wally Hilliard lent $1 million to Jerry Falwell that Jerry Falwell never felt obliged to repay.
Now, you've documented all of these things? How are we able to document the telephone calls from Bill Clinton and George Bush? Were there any records of those?
I've got numerous sources that told me that Hilliard took phone calls from Clinton. He had Clinton's picture in his living room.
And of course, certainly Bill Clinton. Was this when Bill Clinton was the governor? Or was this when he was the president?
Well, I mean, it would have been both.
I see. Okay.
It would have been both. He wouldn't have been governor anymore. He wasn't governor when he ran for president, but we're talking 1999, 2000, 2001.
Okay, fine. All right, fine. Then we're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty with Daniel Hofstetter as we exploring what he's learned about Muhammad Atta. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Daniel Hopsicker, who's an investigative reporter who spent a lot of time in Venice, Florida, trying to track down the background of Muhammad Atta. Did you run into any resistance as you began doing your investigation?
Interesting story, Dr. Stan. When, as you know, I did a book on Barry Seal, the biggest drug smuggler in American history in Mena, Arkansas, who was also, as I discovered, a lifelong CIA agent. And when I would walk into Rich Mountain Aviation in Mena or talk to a former SEAL pilot, Baton Rouge, oftentimes the response was like hostility. It was like, I'm not talking to you. Get away from me. After 9/11, okay, that changed, all right? Even, there was an enormous amount of remorse on the part of people that knew what had really happened, okay? These people are human too. I mean, the people in the CIA, they're human. They certainly were distressed at seeing 3,000 people die horrible deaths. And so I didn't experience too much hostility. Although, I'll tell you one interesting anecdote. I've been coming down to Venice, Florida, a tiny town of 10,000 people, for 25 years to see my folks. And it's such a small town, I had never even seen a police car. And yet, when I came down here to write a book and do a documentary 3 months after 9/11, twice, the first day I was here, I got pulled over twice by the police. And the second time I got pulled over, I said to the officer, I said, you know, you think it might be a good idea if I checked in with the chief of police, told him who I was and why I'm here. And he allowed that could be a good idea. And so the next morning I went down to the Venice police station to identify myself and say, hey, I'm a journalist. I'm going to be poking around. And if you see me out at the airport, you don't have to be. Because it was very tense in Venice, very tense 3 months after 9/11. There were police cars everywhere. There was a police car at the airport 24 hours a day. There was a police car parked in front of the small sewage treatment plant here 24/7. Never did figure that out. So I went in to see the chief of police, and he wasn't available to see me, but he sent out his lieutenant. And I'm so glad that I went to check in, because the lieutenant came out. We chatted for 5 minutes, and I said, I'd like to know just one thing. If you could just answer one question for me. I'd like to know if Rudy Deckers has any local priors, has any local, criminal history.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to just bring our other stations back on board, and I want our listeners to hear your stories. Hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Daniel Hopsicker, an investigative reporter. And about 3 months after 9/11, he went down to Venice, Florida, and he said he had been there many times before. He went there regularly to visit his parents, and suddenly he's pulled over twice by the police the first day. And, of course, he talks to this police officer and suggests, gee, do you think I might do well to go down and talk to the chief of police and let him know that I'm here as an investigative reporter? So Daniel goes down to see the chief of police. The chief of police can't talk to him, but a lieutenant comes out. And suddenly they chat for a while. Daniel asks the lieutenant about this Rudy Decker. Now, who is Rudy Decker again for our listeners?
Is the Dutch man that you all saw on TV everywhere after 9/11 telling us who the terrorists were.
All right.
They had trained at his flight school. He identified Huffman Aviation as his flight school, but he wasn't the true owner. He was just the manager. He was the front man.
All right.
He was the man. Someone told me he was the front man, the man who fronts for the man who really has the money, who was Wally Hilliard.
Who had 40 jets and frequent calls from both George Bush and Bill Clinton, right?
And other people as well. He had a jet that he didn't have to pay for a whole year. He bought it from the former finance head of the Democratic Party, a guy by the name of Truman Arnold. And cost him a dollar. He used the jet for a whole year. I have no idea what that particular relationship was all about. He also owned 4 very expensive Hawker planes in common with a man who was a CIA U-2 pilot. So extensive connection.
All right, fine. So
and he had lent Jerry Falwell $1 million back when Falwell was about to go bust in '94. He stepped up and lent Falwell $1 million, and the story was told to me by his accountant, by Wally Hilliard's accountant, because when this accountant came on board with Wally Hilliard, Hilliard asked him as one of his tasks to attempt to collect the money from Falwell. And so this guy called Falwell's accountant up at Liberty University. And the accountant told him, this is a funny story, the accountant told him, it was very sheepish, and you know, I'd love to pay you the money, we can pay you the money, and confided in this guy that we have plenty of money, there's no reason we can't pay back this $1 million loan, but whenever there's any money in the account at the end of the month, Jerry scoops it out.
Well, anyway, Chris, that would be an entirely different subject you'll have to investigate. Anyway, what did the lieutenant tell you about when you asked him about Rudy Decker?
He gave me the most pained look I can ever remember seeing. He was an honest guy, a local cop. And he looked at me and he said, I would love to be able to tell you about Rudy Decker's prior criminal history. But he said, 2 days after September 11th, the FBI loaded all our records into two Ryder trucks right outside this window, and he pointed to the parking lot out in front of the police station. They loaded all of our records into two Ryder trucks, which were then driven up to the Sarasota airport and driven right onto a C-130 military cargo plane, which then flew to Washington, D.C., with Jeb Bush on board.
And of course, what you're basically saying is they've destroyed the records then on this gentleman.
I thought that story was pretty shocking all by itself, because I wasn't aware that the governor of Florida had any national security responsibilities. And that was, you know, I first found that out, you know, 3 years ago now, 3-4 years ago, and then not too long ago, 6-7 months ago, I finally interviewed the pilot of that on that plane.
And what did he tell you?
The records never got to the FBI.
What happened to them?
I don't know.
Nobody does.
He wouldn't tell me. But the records never got to the FBI. And you know, Dr. Stan, I'm from the Midwest. I mean, you can shock me, you know, a million different ways from Sunday. And I my mouth dropped. What do you mean the records never got to the FBI? Didn't they scream? I mean, what do you mean? You know, and he said, he just shrugged. He said, it's all political. It's all political, he said.
And I think that this really is so true for our listeners. We have to realize that everything having to do with what happened on 9-1-1 has been suppressed. I mean, it is all classified because we can't let Osama bin Laden know. At least that's what they tell us. The truth of the matter is, they can't let the American people know, because imagine the possibility that it turned out we've been lied to about what happened on 9-1-1, that there were explosives, at least in one of the buildings, and that they staged exercises that morning, military exercises to confuse NORAD so they couldn't launch planes to protect the World Trade Center or the Pentagon, and they left those people there to die. What would be the response of the American people if they learned that? If there was a possibility it was true, they could not let the American people know, because that would mean that all the people who died in Afghanistan and Iraq and who are going to die in the coming war with Iran, all unnecessary. We couldn't let the people know that if it were true. And that's why everything has been classified. Everybody who is involved in allowing 9-1-1 to happen, the CIA, the FBI, they've all been promoted. And, of course, the people who have spoken out have all met, some of them have been threatened, and that's the subject of my latest newsletter. If you want a copy of the December newsletter, we'd be glad to send it to you. And it talks about the people, what happened to the people who did come forward and tell the truth. And, of course, all of their lives have been destroyed. So pick the story up there, Daniel.
Well, let me present an alternative scenario. Let's both agree that neither one of us, nobody really outside the circles of you know, inside the government know the true story of what happened on 9/11. But let me present an alternative scenario.
Right, fine.
We learned in Bob Woodward's first book after 9/11, whose name escapes me now, Plan of Attack, I forget the name of it. But, I mean, to me it was a shocking revelation, but it never really surfaced as a big national issue. We learned that, from Bob Woodward, not from me, that the negotiations that we had been having, the government of the U.S. had been having with the government of Afghanistan, had been broken off and had gone poorly. Apparently they were negotiating over a pipeline that was supposed to go across Afghanistan. And we had begun inserting American special forces into Afghanistan during the summer of 2001, before 9/11. This is from Bob Woodward. Now, if you're Mullah Omar, even if you only got one eye, or Osama bin Laden, do you think that that fact completely escaped their attention? I don't. And if I was Mullah Omar or Osama bin Laden, and I learned that I had an enemy that was fixing to go to war with me, might I decide to strike first? Yeah, I think so. And so I think it's at least a plausible scenario that we were double-crossed. And here's what I mean by that, Dr. Stan. If you own a candy store next to a school that I go to, okay, and I stop at your candy store and buy, I remember I used to get Fire Sticks and Good and Funny every day that I could. And I come in your candy store at lunch, you know, the entire school year and buy, some Good and Plenty and the Fire Sticks. And then on the last day of school, I come into your candy store and, you know, here you think I'm just a customer and you're doing business with me and I throw a bomb and destroy your store. Well, you've been double-crossed, haven't you?
Okay, so where are we going?
So, it appears to me, likely, I mean, before I'll believe, and I am like no fan of George W. Bush. I mean, I yield to no man in my distaste and contempt for George W. Bush. And yet, if you tell me that George W. Bush is a child molester, I'm going to need to see evidence before I'm going to believe you, okay?
Right.
I mean, every man deserves a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And before I'll believe that even someone as distasteful to me personally as George W. Bush knew that we were about to be attacked and allowed it to happen, I mean, specifically knew, I need to see proof, and I don't see proof.
Okay.
And I certainly don't believe there were explosives in the World Trade Center.
What about Building 7?
Everything that's come out, okay? I remember the first time I heard the ridiculous argument that the Pentagon hadn't been hit by a plane. And I knew immediately that was a ridiculous argument because I was watching TV that morning. And 20 minutes after the plane hit the Pentagon, they were interviewing on MSNBC, I think I was watching, witnesses that saw the plane, skim, right above the trees. And if those witnesses were lying or were government plants, well, then we may as well just quit because they were better than any actors you've ever seen in your life. They were both incredible. I mean, just they were believable, okay? They had the ring of truth to them, okay? Well, all you have to do is watch that documentary by the two French brothers, okay, that were there. I'm doing a documentary about the fire department in New York. The one that aired on CBS, you know what I'm talking about?
Right. The one that aired on CBS. Go ahead.
And in that documentary, they're talking casually on the afternoon of September 11th. The World Trade Center 7 just came down, And I'm paraphrasing now. And somebody said, they were amazed that it stood as long as it did.
Why would they be amazed it stood as long as it did?
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, build a 100-story building, and then build like a 40-story building next to it, and then have the 100-story building collapse and see what happens to the 40-story building,
well,
okay?
Well, I'll tell you what, of course, the trouble with that, Daniel, is that it wasn't right next, it was a block away. And, of course, there were other buildings very, very close that did not go down. So we have to ask why, but I don't want to argue with you. Are you entitled to your opinion?
No. It's not like arguing points like this are it's not that there's anything distasteful about it, okay? What a discussion like we're having right now points up is how little we've been allowed to know about what really happened.
And I think you're absolutely right. To see, the thing is that when there is an intelligence operation, they never tell the president. Any more than with Iran-Contra, they told certainly President Reagan what was going on. He wanted something done. That was up to the intelligence community. George Bush wanted something done. I don't think that he knew what was going to happen.
Let me persist here a little bit, okay?
Okay.
There are some people who think that nothing ever happens bad in this world that the U.S. government isn't responsible for. And I'm not one of them. I think my government does horrible things every day that, if I were in charge, would stop immediately. But is the U.S. government in charge of all evil in the world so that when something particularly evil happens, like 9/11, we immediately point the finger at them as if there could be no other responsible parties?
Well, who do you think...
I'm not... Who?
Could I simply ask you one thing? And that is why, if there's nothing to conceal, were the testimony of 1,100 people who testified before the 911 Commission sealed for 50 years so that we could never know what actually happened that day?
There's tons to conceal. The terrorists were here because somebody in the U.S. government was making money running selling Osama bin Laden's heroin to Americans. Isn't that something to conceal?
Well, I think that the American people should have a right to know, don't you?
Of course they should. Of course they should.
And don't you think, for instance, I interviewed people who were actually in the North Tower the morning of the attack, and there were explosions in the building, at the basement of the building, before anything hit the top of the building. That testimony was suppressed. I would think that at least should be brought out and questioned. And the man who made that charge, a man named Mr. William Rodriguez, was threatened. Had harassment, they arranged so he couldn't get a job. Who could have done that? Do you think that was Osama bin Laden who was threatening William Rodriguez and breaking into his home, just like they did with Michael Rupert, just like they did with so many
Michael
of the people
Rupert?
Who spoke to him?
Wait, Michael Rupert?
Yeah, they broke into his office, and in fact they had FBI agents.
Prove that?
What?
Michael Rupert is the worst thing that ever happened to finding out the truth about 9/11.
Why? Why do you say that?
Because peak oil didn't kill those people on the plane.
Well, what is Michael... That has nothing to do with the issue of what happened on 9/11. I mean...
Right, exactly.
I think that...
Exactly. And yet Michael Rupert... I hate to point it out, but the fact of the matter is that I'm the only independent investigator that put boots on the ground and knocked on doors. Rupert was a homicide investigator. And if you ask him what homicide investigators do in a homicide investigation, which is what 9/11 is, he would tell you that a homicide investigator goes out and knocks on the doors of the next-door neighbors and interviews the associates, family, and friends of the perps, the perpetrators, or the suspected perpetrators, to find out what happened.
Well, what did
Rupert do? He flew off to Russia.
I think Michael Rupert's contribution, and major contribution, was the fact that he brought out the fact that there were military exercises that morning that simulated planes crashing into buildings. That's been confirmed by another number of other sources.
Right, and let me tell you something, Dr. Stan. Anything Michael Rupert says, I guarantee you that the opposite is true. Michael Rupert went on and on about how NORAD was responsible for not taking action. Well, I was at the 9/11 Commission hearing, and you know who was responsible? It was the FAA.
I see. Well, of course,
the FAA was responsible. The FAA didn't report to the military that there was something the military needed to know about until it was too late. FAA.
What?
You know why? The FAA is a dirt. As dirty a federal organization as I've seen.
All right, fine.
The FAA covered up for the flight school owner and for Mohammed Atta right here in Florida. The FAA. It wasn't NORAD. It was the FAA.
I see. Fine. One question I would simply ask you is, who was it who was implanting all those false images on the radar screen at the FAA and at NORAD that morning that so confused them that they couldn't figure out what was going on? Have you heard the NORAD tapes?
Okay, we're talking, what are they trying to hide?
What are they trying to hide?
Hey, we're
out of time, Daniel. Thank you so much. Oh, wait a minute. Hang on. I just want you to get up your webpage.
MadCowProd.com.
Okay, what now? Say it slowly so people can get the address.
I'd much rather take the time and tell you what they're trying to hide, Dr. Stan. I've enjoyed talking to you. www.madcowprod.com. MadCowProd.com.
Now, what do you think that they're trying to hide?
The fact that all the billions we were paying for defense and all the billions we were paying for intelligence, they were more interested in the CIA agents were in their Cayman Islands bank accounts than they were in protecting the U.S. And all the billions we were paying in defense couldn't keep us from being attacked. They were all flummoxed that morning. Flummoxed. Nobody more than the FAA.
Well,
if you want to point a finger, point it at the FAA, because they're the ones that were responsible for not reporting to NORAD.
Thing I would ask you, ordinarily, I mean, I think about every year there are 40 or 50 times where there's a simulated hijacking. Ordinarily, the FAA reports to NORAD. NORAD scrambles jets, and of course they intercept the plane. Why didn't they do that morning? Why on that one morning was the FAA so totally inefficient?
That's an excellent question, and from what I've seen in Florida, that organization, the FAA, is one of the dirtiest federal organizations that exist, and I would love to know the answer. But I will leave you with one thought, okay? And that is a quote from a famous writer named Thomas Pynchon, and he said, if they can get you to ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
Well, did I ask the wrong question? I thought I asked the right question.
No. I'm not saying you asked the wrong questions. I'm just saying I think that's something to think about, because we can all agree, 2 weeks after 9/11, we could all agree that there was a massive cover-up going on, right?
Right.
So, if you were in charge of the cover-up, say your name was Karl Rove. Not saying it was him, but if you were Karl Rove, 2 weeks after 9/11, you would have said, well, you'd have felt pretty good. We got the major media's handled, okay? Nobody's asking too many questions. The story's going over. What do you got to worry about? You have to worry about the Internet, the only free form of expression allowed to us these days. And what their response was, I would submit to you, was they flooded it with bullpucky. They flooded it with disinformation.
And I'm very much afraid you're absolutely right. There's so many stories out there, all designed to confuse us. We're out of time, Daniel. Thank you so very much for being with us. And once again, your website is?
MadCowProd.com. Dr. Sand, a pleasure to be with you. Enjoyed it.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks so very much.
Take care.
And our guest has been Daniel Hupsinger. And, of course, he's written several books. This is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon was Daniel Hupsinger, and he's an investigative reporter, and certainly we wanted you to hear his divergent point of view, which differs from mine, but that's what makes horse racing. Under any circumstances, if you'd like to know what my opinion is on what really happened that day, on 9/11, we hope you'll want to get our Foreknowledge 9/11 pamphlets. They're three little pamphlets, and we're going to make another one out of my last five newsletters. You can get them on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. The August, September, October, November, and very soon the November newsletter will be posted there. And we hope you'll pull them down and read them. And then you'll get a book that we carry. It's called See No Evil is written by a gentleman who was a CIA agent, the highest ranking CIA official in Iraq during the 1990s. He was, of course, stationed in Kurdistan. He couldn't be in Iraq itself, but that was part of Iraq. And he simply quotes one of the highest-ranking CIA officials in Washington, D.C., as saying off the record, "When the dust finally settles, the American people will realize that what happened on 9/11 was a triumph for intelligence, not a failure. When the dust finally clears, the American people will realize that what happened on 9/11 was a triumph for intelligence, not a failure." And 3,000 Americans were dead. 1,100 of their bodies have never been recovered. Were they crushed when the buildings collapsed? Were they vaporized when the buildings exploded? If you'd like the book, we carry it, See No Evil by Robert Baer. And then, of course, we have, of course, a new four-tape set on why did the buildings collapse. It's in the process of being put out. It's with interviews by people who were actually there that morning. We have to get the truth out. We have 5 DVDs on the subject, and if you'd like to get them, they're 9/11 Press for the Truth, the story of the four widows whose husbands died in the Twin Towers and their effort to get to the truth, and everything that was done to suppress the information so they couldn't get the truth. And then, of course, 9/11 Mystery, Terror Storm, In Plain Sight, and lastly, The Day That Changed America Forever. We hope you'll get some or all of the DVDs. You get them all together at a special price. And then, of course, we want you to show them to others. We have to understand that this, what is going on, is part of something much larger. The whole plan, of course, is to expand the war in the Middle East, not to cut back as the American people want. Certainly the American people don't want to go to war with Iran and expand the war. The Iranian people don't want to get involved in a war with the United States and bring horror and havoc to their people. And the American people don't want the complications that have come when we enter World War III. But it's coming very rapidly. If you haven't made your preparations, let me suggest if you'd like a food catalog or a medical catalog, or just a regular catalog of our products, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. They have massive bunkers in Washington, D.C., one of them under Dick Cheney's home. And, of course, they blasted out a large bunker for Cheney and his family very deep in the ground because they know what lies ahead. They've done the same thing for the leaders in Washington, D.C., and laid in food supplies and bunkers where they'll be safe. And they're not doing anything to protect the American people, and we have to ask why. You need to read the Military Commission Act and the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act to realize, of course, they established new legislation that, according to Patrick Leahy, will encourage martial law in the United States in case of a national emergency. Why would they have passed that just within the last month? Why are they putting out $38 million to refurbish the Japanese concentration camps in Utah and elsewhere under the guise of, well, we don't want Americans ever to forget how horrible it is to put people in concentration camps? And why are they appropriated $385 million for Halliburton to build new detention camps? Go up on the Internet. If you can't document it, we'll be glad to provide you with the information. And lastly, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.